outside her underwear to her knees and exposed the mess between her legs. I could see the tears descend down her pudgy cheeks, but her face didn't move. They weren't tears of sadness or fear, but of quiet resignation. My mother seemed satisfied. "Okay, then. Clean yourself up and go back to bed." She left the room, content with her findings, and I began to dry my eyes. I tiptoed into my room and tried to get beneath the covers as quietly as possible. Watching Erica adorably snore, I cursed at her for not waking up. Then I inched my way toward her sleeping body, wrapped my arm around her back, and lay awake until the morning, my mind unable to shut off. I knew that was not my mother who made me do those things. I wondered, could she also melt away from herself? Or had something vile, after years of closing in on her, finally gained complete control? If it could take over my mother, could it one day swallow me whole as well? There's a recurring dream I have, where I'm standing over my mother as she sleeps. She looks so peaceful and innocent, unsullied by the wickedness of her illness. After watching her for a moment, I notice it in the corner of the room. The darkness preparing to engulf her. I know there's nothing I can do. It is waiting. It is too late. But it lets me say goodbye. I lean over and gently kiss her warm forehead. I hover there, close enough to feel her breath in my face. I look at this beautiful woman and whisper, "I love you, Ma. I'm so sorry." Chapter 5, A Step-by-Step Guide on How to Turn into Your Mother. As I got older, Ma's transformation into a Lifetime Channel movie villain continued. It was as if the more I learned about the real world, the more I became a part of it, the more she feared losing her grip on me. She had to find a way to hold on tighter. Watching me like a hawk, Ma saw every move I made as a cause for interrogation. Every pimple was proof I was dirty. Every pound gained was a painful reminder of how pretty and skinny I used to be. Every male classmate who looked in my direction was the secret father of my non-existent baby. It set my nerves on edge. I never knew whom I was going to get when I walked through the door. Would I get a smile from the vibrant woman cooking rice and beans while blasting Mark Anthony on her boombox? Or would I get the pissed-off crone wondering if I was home 10 minutes later than usual because I had to give a quick BJ before catching my bus? Even if Ma was in a good mood, there was no guarantee that wouldn't change an hour later. There was no way to tell what would set her off. She would spend most of the day locked away in her room, and each time the door creaked open, I would get a painful twinge in my stomach. My body was beginning to expect the worst as well. I even developed a twitch. Every time I felt a hint of anxiousness creeping in, my neck would jerk my head from side to side and push my chin forward. I had no control over it. Eventually, it became as natural as a blink. I didn't think anyone had really noticed it, but old Hawkeyes did. The second Ma pointed out my odd neck movement, its frequency went off the charts. "Stop moving your head like you have Tourette's," Ma would gently chide. The more she would notice, the more would happen, until one day she had enough. Making me step into the shower fully clothed, Ma turned the shower head on as cold as it would go and let me know I could leave once I stopped twitching. Her method may have been suspect, but it was surprisingly effective. Though I had gotten my twitch mostly in check, I was more uneasy being at home than ever. A slam door here, a loud drop of a TV remote there. Even without words, Ma was making the plentiful hair on my arm stand at high alert. One day, as I was washing the dishes from dinner, Ma slammed the freezer's door. I was so jumpy that the sound made me wildly flinch. The two glasses I held in my hands collided, shattering upon impact. I had smashed them together so hard, the glass crumbled into hundreds of tiny pieces, covering the entirety of my arms and chest. I held my breath and froze with my arms outstretched, half because I was hoping Ma hadn't noticed, and half because I was covered in frickin' shards of glass. I didn't know what to do. Luckily for me, Ma had indeed noticed and was already on her way, washcloth in hand. You can't even do the dishes right. Why do you have to be so fucking worthless? Ma had been harsh in the past. She had scared me and made me cry. She had cracked me across the back or upside the head to keep me in check, and I would have preferred those slaps to those words. She had never been that mean. She had never called me worthless. It cut deeper than the glass jutting out of my palm. A familiar, frenzied look entered her eyes, and I feared what would come next. She moved my arms from the sink to my side, straightening my elbows and moving my palms out, making pieces of glass fall to the ground like a rain of diamonds. It's all over the floor now. You got it all over the floor. I have to clean all of this, on top of finishing the dishes, since you can't seem to handle such a simple job. As she muttered a stream of curses underneath her breath, she wet the washcloth and began to use it to knock the glass off my shirt and into the pile around my feet. She moved the towel to my arms, roughly dragging it down the exposed skin. You're hurting me, I tried to plead, but she was focused on the mission at hand. Pressing the washcloth onto my arms just pushed the tiny pieces of glass into the skin. Moving the cloth dragged the shards down my arms, scratching the whole way. When she was done, I was torn to ribbons. One piece of glass had been so strongly pushed into my flesh, it remained burrowed under the skin of my wrist 3 months later. My nervousness at home was perpetual. I had the anxiety level of a chihuahua taking Adderall during a thunderstorm. I needed to find a way to alleviate it before I shattered like broken glass. Robbie, noticing the bizarre wrath I was incurring, became kinder and more accepting of me than he had ever been before. He actually invited me to use his new PlayStation. Having saved months of checks from his first job as a cashier, Robbie rewarded himself with a gaming system he had coveted for years. Watching the PlayStation symbol grace the screen of the television was as close to a religious experience as I had ever had. Inviting Erica along for the ride, we all sat on his futon and played Resident Evil Nemesis for hours on end. The game's heroine was Jill Valentine, a petite brunette who could not only wear the hell out of leather, but also managed to wield a grenade launcher while fighting hordes of zombies. This was my kind of chick. Before I knew it, we had sunk weeks into the game, beating it over and over again. It felt cathartic to blast zombies away into chunky little pieces. There was something about seeing this strong, stylized female lead holding her own and taking out the bad guys that spoke to me. It was like a comic book I could control and be immersed in. Next, we played Metal Gear Solid, and again I was graced with the presence of badass heroes in the form of gun-toting Solid Snake and Meryl Silverberg. I loved escaping to this world, a world where I could be a capable powerhouse. I quite literally had the control. I had the power. When stress began to take its toll, I would escape to the worlds of Tomb Raider, Final Fantasy, Need for Speed, Mega Man, Soul Reaver, and Silent Hill. Screw the real world. I was no longer the fragile victim. Video games made me the hero of my own story. Robbie even invited me to watch wrestling with him again. While we hopped around from apartment to apartment, I had lost interest in trying to keep up with the show. When I sat down and watched an episode with him, I was taken aback by how it had all evolved. No longer was the only female representation the demure, dainty flower Miss Elizabeth. The women who now graced my screen were muscular and overtly sexualized. They now competed inside of the ring instead of just valeting a male wrestler. They even mixed it up with the guys in intergender matches. I was floored. I had thought spandex-wearing heroines had only existed within the pages of my comics or pixelated games. But here were real-life, flesh-and-blood ass-kickers. Some of the women were jacked and tough as nails. The others were gorgeous blonde bombshells. All of them were confident, interesting pieces of the show. I watched as they received brutal beatings and doled them out twice as hard. Robbie and I would sit down twice a week and cheer on our favorites. Eddie Guerrero, Chyna, The Rock, Rey Mysterio, Kane, the Hardy Boys and Lita, Chris Benoit, and Shane and Stephanie McMahon. On days as rare and glorious as a unicorn, we would hit up the PlayStation for a couple of hours, turn on Monday Night Raw, and then create ourselves in Create a Wrestler mode in the WWF's PlayStation game, SmackDown. I cherished this time with my brother. I had been so scared of my surroundings, so unsure of myself. But in trying to help me out and take my mind off things, he inadvertently introduced me to exactly who I wanted to become. I wanted to be as brave as Jill Valentine and Meryl Silverberg. I wanted to be as memorable as Aerith, as skilled as Lara Croft, as strong as Chun-Li and Katana. But I needed it to be real. I needed to experience the power and strength with my own hands in real life. The amazing women in the WWF were the closest to the leading ladies as I could ever get. "I'm going to be a professional wrestler when I grow up," I proudly announced to my mother at the age of 12. "It's not a real job, baby," she muttered, walking right past me. You never forget your first. Stabbing. As I was preparing to enter high school, Robbie was preparing to leave it. Mere months away from graduating, he was tired of his tumultuous life at home. Ma's erratic behavior had begun to rub off on Dad, and he too exhibited signs of change and increased violence. Robbie would always fall into something that would cause him to get smacked around by Dad. I remember crying my eyes out when Dad knocked a bowl of cereal out of Robbie's hand because he wasn't making enough eye contact while being yelled at. The tension between the Mendez parents and children was at an all-time high. Erica had rebelled and discovered boys and parties. She made the mistake of staying out too late one night. Dad threw a mug at her head the second she entered the door. As she cowered, all curled up in a crying mess on the floor, Dad wouldn't back off. He kept yelling and yelling, throwing out nasty names that made my blood boil. I was scared he would hit her the way he smacked around Robbie. I had enough. I was all hyped on my newfound hope to one day be my own Wonder Woman, and I figured now was a good place to start. "Leave her alone," I shouted with all my mousy might. "What did you just say to me?" Dad was infuriated. "If you want to hit someone, hit me," I stupidly challenged. I had been watching so much wrestling, I was sure I figured out the trick to taking a punch was just gritting your teeth. I could do that if it meant sparing my sister. Plus, I was going to have to start getting physically tougher at some point. I considered this practice. Dad power walked up to me like a fuming bull, but I did my best not to budge. I clenched my teeth, thinking this was my moment to prove I could take a beating like the wrestlers did. I met his eyes and didn't flinch. This pissed him off. He reared back and punched clean through the closet door behind me, sending wooden splinters flying around my head. "You're not my daughter anymore," he yelled, storming off. I didn't know what that meant. Did it mean I wasn't acting like myself? If so, good. I didn't like meek Chihuahua AJ anymore. I needed to be stronger. Did it mean I was being disowned? As if I should be punished for not being afraid of a man with a balled-up fist? For standing up for myself and for another person? What kind of message was that to send to your own daughter? That cowering is a correct response? Not only was I upset about all the possibilities, in a strange way, I felt empowered. I was becoming a different person. And I liked who she was. But Robbie was tired of cowering. He was also tired of moving around like gypsies and needed a way out. Unfortunately, my parents had no money and no plan to send him to college. Having average grades, he couldn't get the scholarships necessary to put him through school either. And so, at the age of 18, he entered the Army's Airborne Infantry Unit. A year later, 9/11 happened right across the river in New York, and my big brother was sent off to war. He had joined the army with the intention of finding stability, of escaping turmoil at home, and he ended up deep within it. Before he left for basic training, he surprised me with my very own PlayStation 2, the latest gaming system. "I'll kick your ass on it when I get back," he promised, as I wondered how long it would be until I saw him again. My rock was gone, and the apartment returned to constant hostile territory. I felt for my dad. He seemed to blame himself for pushing Robbie out the door. I knew Dad's violence wasn't representative of who he really was. He's the softy who brings home strays. He's not a bad person. The level of strain thrust onto our family when my mother began her downward spiral was intense and more than anyone could handle alone. Here he was, trying to keep this roof over our heads while his wife descended into a mysterious darkness none of us could explain. I understood how the pressure and stress began to break him too. While I began my first years of high school, Robbie toured Iraq and Afghanistan. In his care packages, I would include handwritten letters, decorated with colored marker drawings, because I figured he could use a little pop of enthusiasm in his day. I also thought it was essential to include match-by-match rundowns and detailed play-by-plays of every episode of WWF shows. I didn't want him to miss out on the storylines we had bonded over and were invested in. I probably should have figured he had more important things to worry about. "You don't have to write me 7 pages about wrestling," he let me know in a brief, static-filled phone call. "Just let me know if you ever grow into your giant head." Without my brother around to bring me out of my shell, I withdrew into solitude. I felt weaker somehow. Like not having the only person who understood what I dreamed of becoming was somehow making it less attainable. Naturally, my snark multiplied. I had found strength in standing up for myself once, and I continued to use my words as protection. "You've turned into a real smartass," Ma would say, as if that were supposed to be an insult. But the day I invited my dad to take a swing was the last time either of my parents hit me. It was as if my demonstration of nerve had earned some perverse respect. Psychologically, my mother would continue to find new and exciting ways to torment me, but it was quietly understood there was no way to scare me physically anymore. In numbing my nerves, I began to believe my own strength. I was proud to be a smartass. This smart mouth was going to build armored walls around me and keep me safe. When the holidays came around, my mom wanted to drive into Manhattan for Christmas Eve dinner with her relatives. It had been quite some time since our little band of merry misfits had been invited, and coincidentally, it had also been some time since my parents last asked any of them for money. Going to these family gatherings had once held a special place in my heart. When my parents couldn't afford to buy us Christmas presents, an aunt or uncle would bring a bag of extra toys to our family gathering and make sure the Mendez kids had at least one present to unwrap. I was so appreciative to receive my first childhood baby doll at one of these dinners. Over 20 years later, I haven't had the heart to get rid of it. Though I probably should, since it now looks like it's haunted. But the more dependent on them we became, the less they wanted to share their holidays. Having become a little ball of bitterness, I asked to be excused from the evening. "We don't ever celebrate Christmas. We don't give each other presents. Why are we going to start now?" I made my case. "Because these people are your family, and family is supposed to be together on the holidays," Dad tried to convince me. "Is this the same family that let us live in a car?" I bit back. "You know what?" Ma interrupted. "Just leave her home alone if she wants to be a little Grinch. I don't want you embarrassing me with your smart mouth anyway." The Grinch had a pretty sweet dog. I pushed my face against Muggsy's like we were posing for a cheesy Kmart photo op. I was psyched. I had taken a trip to Hollywood Video and rented a VHS of Akira, Kazuhiro Otomo's sci-fi anime classic. My interest had now broadened to all things anime, and it was an essential part of the education. "It's just you and me, Muggsy," I said as I popped the tape into the mouth of the impressive TV-VHS combo my dad had recently found on a curb, cuddling up with my little pup. Except by this time, he wasn't really little. He was the size of a very small but very fat horse. Though he thought his overwhelming frame could still comfortably fit within my comparatively diminutive lap, he curled up across me like one of those circus bears trying to ride a T-bicycle. I began to stroke his fur and sing his favorite song, You Are My Sunshine, and as he drifted off to sleep, he felt twice as chunky. I thought it was endearing. Muggsy had convinced himself he was still the size of a puppy, but frustrated that I would now be trapped underneath a boulder for the next few hours. Still, my night had to be miles ahead of a family function filled with phony smiles and stilted conversation. Even if my company tended to lick his own crotch in front of me, at least I knew it was company I could rely on. I was sure Muggsy's fur released some kind of tryptophan, because every time he fell asleep on me, I would inevitably doze off soon after. As I strained to stay conscious and finish my movie, a loud bang snapped me awake. We now lived in a basement apartment, which is just as dreary as it sounds. The subterranean abode would not only flood during a heavy rain, but its windows would also amplify all the noises of the all-too-close street they faced. I assumed someone had hastily thrown some garbage in a can out front and went back to watching my movie. But then the bang happened again. Muggsy leaped off my lap in a single bound, scratching my legs through my sweatpants. In an instant, he was snarling and barking at the door, letting me know he did not like whoever was on the other side. I looked through the peephole and was startled to see a man slumped over in the hallway. I watched as he used all his strength to throw his body against the door again. Muggsy was in full-on guard dog mode, his instincts for protection kicking in. He was not about to let anyone come in and harm the lady who serenades him. But instead of letting the 100-pound furry security guard handle his business, I irrationally worried about what the guy on the other side of the door might do to him. Upon further inspection through the peephole, his mouth was foaming and his eyes were almost inhuman.
Roberto!
Oh, so this was what one of Dad's new friends looked like. I naturally assumed the guy was on drugs and began to dial 911. But he had stopped throwing himself at the door, seemingly giving up on his search for my dad. Moments later, there was a crack against one of the front windows, and I almost screamed in response. The man wasn't gaining entry through the front door, so he figured he would just pop in through a window. My mind raced. This man would soon easily crawl into the apartment. I needed to protect Muggsy. I was home alone. What would Kevin McAllister do? Realizing I did not have access to marbles, let alone the time to properly set up an effective human trap, I found the next best thing, a steak knife. My dad let us know Mr. Pointy was easily accessible inside of a kitchen drawer. In his own words, if you ever need to shank a fool. Well, here was a fool, and he needed shanking. Muggsy wasn't about to grow an opposable thumb and do it, so I guess I needed to step up. I watched as the stranger's hand successfully punched a hole through the window screen. My heartbeat pulsed inside of my throat. Luckily, he was so out of it, he couldn't process how to unlatch the lock to slide it up. But his dry, dirty hands roamed inside of the sill, desperately looking for a way in.
Roberto!
He continued to yell as if Dad would happily greet him at the busted window frame. I dialed 911 on the landline while my hands shook around the rusty steak knife. I was okay for now. The police were on their way. If he kept fiddling around the lock, I would scare him off with a knife. As I tried to calm myself down, I saw his hand bend around the frame and grab hold of the lock. Fuck this noise. I'm going in. Screaming at the top of my lungs, I wildly waved my weapon at his arms. He shrieked, seemingly noticing my brandished blade, but it did nothing to stop his hands from fiddling around the lock. He pushed the screen up, dropped his hands to the sill, and lowered his head through the foot-tall opening. He was going to try to wriggle through the small gap instead of just continuing to lift the screen the whole way. His cracked-out mind was doing me a favor. As his hands tried to pull the rest of his body through, I uncontrollably stabbed at them. Somehow, over my banshee screams, I heard the blade connect with skin. A thick, wet sound that made me gag in return. It seemed to do the trick, and he retreated in a flash. Minutes later, the police arrived to scold me. You know, that giant pit bull would probably make a great guard dog if you didn't lock him in a back room. Now, I'm not saying stabbing an intruder is the smartest or safest thing in the world, but I must admit, getting myself out of a dangerous situation using nothing but quick thinking and balls of steel certainly made me feel stronger than I thought I was. I felt more in control. I felt safer behind the strength of my own hands. But over time, merely reading a comic, watching someone else's story unfold in a role-playing game, or dreaming of one day being a pro wrestler wasn't enough to drown out the anxiety anymore. I thought I had found a way to stop my twitch, but I really just somehow traded it in for full-on obsessive-compulsive disorder. I found myself having to crack each knuckle in a very specific order after finishing every homework assignment. Before leaving a room, I absolutely had to rub both palms on every edge and corner inside of it. Of course, I would wash my hands right after, because I eventually needed to wash my hands after I touched literally anything. The delicate skin on my fingers began to crack and bleed after a particularly handsy day. The hand sanitizer I needed to have in my pocket at all times would burn when applied to the fissures, but at least I knew the germs were gone. I started having trouble sleeping. At first, any creak or noise I heard when the lights were off would make me fear someone was trying to break in again. And when that chill of paranoia ran down my spine, it was soon followed by the nauseating memory of the squishy sound of popping skin. By around 2 a.m., I would finally fall asleep, but only a few hours later, my alarm would go off and I would need to get ready for school. My body began to anticipate the early alarm, and I would wake up half an hour before it, making my night of sleep even shorter. As time went on, I would take longer to fall asleep, and instinctively I'd wake up earlier and earlier. Ultimately, these habits met somewhere in the middle, and I became a bona fide insomniac. I needed to take action, but only my make-believe worlds of crime fighters and saviors had been able to soothe the beast in my brain, so I decided to step it up. I found strength in control. So now I would control the narrative. For every video game or anime that ended in happily ever after, I would open a notebook and write the ever after. I was creating fan fictions before I even knew what fanfic was. I would continue the stories I loved so much so they would always be with me. I could make the heroines say what I wished they had said before, but that wasn't enough. I then started drawing my own characters and creating original stories. When I lay awake in bed, unable to sleep before school, I would quietly crawl out of it, prop a flashlight onto my desk, open a notebook, and enter the worlds created by my own hand. When stress would overcome me, or I had a fight with my mother, I would take a pencil to a blank sheet of paper and create a new protagonist who would defend me from pain. Writing and drawing seemed to be doing the trick. My mind calmed a bit. I still couldn't sleep, but now I only had to push my palms against the corners of the desk before leaving the bedroom. It was progress. Even though my mind was now preoccupied, my body was itching to join the game. I had curbed my loose hand ways a while back, after Ma had found out I was punching randos in school. If only there was a way someone could just let me hit them, not out of rage, but for practice. I promised myself I would become my own superhero and enter the world of professional wrestling when I was of legal age, but I didn't want to wait that long. And that's when having all guy friends really paid off. My friends were into wrestling just as much as I was, and after discussing our dreams of squared circle stardom, we decided we would just create our own wrestling federation. At lunch and after school, we would all meet in the park and practice the moves we had seen on TV. Since I was the only girl, I was designated as the referee, so none of the guys had to feel bad about clotheslining me in the neck. But they would let me try moves on them after their matches. I would jump off plastic slides with a flying crossbody and practice drop kicks on the softer patches of grass. And each of the boys was kind enough to let me try out forearms on their faces. It was so deeply stupid. There's a reason they advise kids, do not try this at home. Someone would always end up breaking a finger or a nose, and dozens of times the cops were called to kick us out of the park. Apparently, actual children didn't like playing on bloody monkey bars, pansies. But I was hooked. I was inspired. I wanted to inspire. I believed I was meant for better things than car living, break-ins, and glass baths. I would create my own way out. Pashiki Yuki. Erica had worked hard and scored some scholarships to send her to a good college. After graduating, there was practically an Erica-shaped hole in our front door. She was not as understanding of our parents' devolving ways as I tried to be, as I needed to be. She, like Robbie before her, just wanted out. She picked a school that would not be easy for her parents to drive to on a weekend, and she never looked back. I was happy for her, but also scared of what being alone in this place would mean for me. I was basically Claire Danes watching Kate Beckinsale walk out of the Thai prison at the end of Brokedown Palace. Or maybe I was as angst-ridden as Claire Danes in my so-called life. Whatever, I just wanted to be Claire Danes. I decided to formulate my own plans of escape. I wanted to go to a school that would encourage my blooming creativity. My grades were ideal, and I was in the top 10% of my class, but I enjoyed writing and creating more than science and math. When I started to look at colleges, I found amazing options all over the United States that would help me grow as an artist. But moving so far from home seemed an impossible task. I worried for my parents. Living without Robbie and Erica had, in a way, broken their spirits. Sure, your average parent understands that spreading your wings and flying from the nest is a natural, healthy, positive part of life. But Janet and Robert were not your ordinary parents. They were dependent on their children. Not only did we serve to bring order, tranquility, and rational thinking to decision-making and everyday life, but my parents relied on us for the most basic of things. Robbie and Erica used their meager savings from part-time jobs as supermarket cashiers to help pay rent. Janet used our social security numbers to open cable accounts and home phone lines when too many unpaid bills piled up in her name. Erica shouldered most of the burden, acting as a surrogate mother to us all. She would organize the bills that came through the mail and try to remind Ma and Dad to pay them on time. She would carry heavy loads of laundry several blocks, all by herself, to the laundromat in town, so we would all have clean clothes for the week. She would work overtime at ShopRite to make sure I had a gift on my birthday. She was such a little adult at a young age. Once, when she was around 10, she cut herself while preparing dinner and walked 10 minutes to a CVS so she could steal a Band-Aid. There was no way we had enough money to buy a whole box. Unfortunately, she was caught in the act, but a kind-hearted CVS employee, seeing how bloody her little finger was, snuck one bandage out of the pack and told her to take it and run. Janet and Robert felt safer knowing there was someone else around to carry the burden, even if those hands were ridiculously tiny. I knew I couldn't just take off and leave them behind. I decided to try to find a school I could travel home from so I could take care of my parents. My perfect match was NYU, New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, became my dream school. Not only could I study writing, performing, filmmaking, and animation, I would only be one train and one bus ride away from home, just in case. The only problem was NYU is expensive as hell. We had no money. This seemed like a pickle. So I did some research. I found out my grades could help me get some grants and scholarships, and our household income being only slightly more than that of our apartment's roaches would help me qualify for financial aid. Ma had spent so long ruining her children's credit scores, hers had ample time to repair itself, and she would be able to apply for loans to pay for the rest. Basically, the financial burden of education would be something I could worry about in the future, after graduating. The problem was what was asked of me in the present. I was required to apply for early admission to enter Tisch, and should I be accepted, I would need $500 to hold my spot in the freshman class. I needed to start making my own money. I sold my collection of WWF magazines on eBay. 3 days a week, I got paid under the table to clean the bathrooms at a local daycare. Between that and my future obsession with cardigan sweaters, I had all the birth control I would ever really need. But $25 a week to clean up baby poop was not going to get me where I needed to go. I entered various poetry and writing contests and ended up winning hundreds of dollars in first place prizes. Not only was I awarded exactly what I needed to hold my dream spot in school, I had some money left over to spend on anything I could dream of. I had never held so much money in my hands. The possibilities seemed endless. Now I just needed to get accepted. All my friends, many also applying early to NYU, were discussing safety and backup schools just in case the stacked odds were too much to overcome. That seemed ridiculous to me. I knew exactly what I wanted, and there was no way I would let any other possibility enter the world, even through thought. Why did everyone want to play it so safe? If you are tightrope walking between two skyscrapers, the last thing you want to do is look down. I chose full steam ahead. At the beginning of my senior year, I decided to apply to only one school, my dream school. Unfortunately for me, my anxiety reared its ugly head, mutating into what I now know was a hatchling of depression. But at 17, I had no idea what was happening. All I knew was that sometimes I would stay awake an entire night thinking about death. The death of my loved ones and of myself. I would horrify myself with worst possible scenarios and begin the next school day exhausted and paranoid. Some days I would actually get 3 full hours of sleep and wake up feeling refreshed. I would have a great day at school and come home full of positivity, but the rush of good energy seemed to come crashing down hard, and I would lock myself inside of the bathroom, pretending to be showering, and cry for 20 straight minutes. It started to scare me. I couldn't pinpoint this feeling growing within my chest and gut. I just knew that something felt missing. And no matter what I tried to do to feel complete, the hole just seemed to swallow all attempts, growing bigger, stronger, emptier. My health began to fail. Somehow my mind's ailments conjured themselves into a physical form. My asthma came back with a vengeance, and I now required a bulky machine called a nebulizer to be strapped to my face for a few hours a day to help open up my lungs. However, I used those hours to perfect my psychomantis impression. I would eventually miss over 30 days of my senior year. Sometimes this was because I felt ill. More often, it was because I woke up feeling like I was cloaked in a lead blanket. I couldn't peel myself off the bed. I couldn't dress myself. I dreaded the idea of opening the front door and moving within the world, while I felt so damn heavy. My parents supported my decision to stay home because it meant we could hang out and watch TV together. The actual process of applying to NYU began to haunt me. I had filled out my entire application, which, interestingly enough, included my own Metal Gear Solid fanfic, but I couldn't find the strength to mail it out. For weeks, it lay on the top of my desk, mocking me. There was no way I could actually make it into such a prestigious school. I was a poor kid from Jersey. Those spots would be reserved for the rich kids who could actually afford it. I bet they didn't have to mop floors and chase down bare-ass, crying 3-year-olds who forgot their pants in the bathroom just to pay the deposit. Every day, I would pass the glowing folder holding the dozens of pages of fastidiously prepared essays and documents. It would call out, "Send me! Put a goddamn stamp on my face!" But I would ignore it. On the last possible day to mail it in on time to meet the early admissions deadline, I grabbed the folder on my way out the door. But first, I figured I would comb through just to make sure my work was up to snuff. While I perused the mountain of papers, I felt my heart beat a little bit faster. Sweat slowly soaked through the fabric beneath my underarms. My chest tightened. "Oh, shit," I thought. Was I having an asthma attack? I grabbed my nebulizer and flipped its switch, holding the mask to my face. This was a really embarrassing way to go out. Death by paperwork. But then I felt tears fill up the inside of the plastic mask. An asthma attack doesn't usually make me cry like a baby who forgot her pants in the bathroom. Something was wrong, and I didn't know what. Hearing the ruckus, Smile worriedly ran out of her bedroom. "What's happening? Are you having an asthma attack?" "I don't think so. I just can't stop crying. I don't know why I'm crying. I'm sweating so much, I responded, confused out of my face. Fine, you can stay home from school today if it means you'll stop acting crazy, she said, then returned to bed. Well, at least I had an out from school. But what was happening to my body? I assumed it must be the application. Was my body trying to warn me it was all wrong? The solution was clear. I was going to have to tear it all up. It was garbage. I would just simply redo the entire application in one morning and get it to the post office before the day's cutoff. I don't know what muse or pixie was watching over me, but somehow I actually rewrote all my questionnaires and essays in one sitting. I mailed the application out on time and even made it to school by fifth period. And I have almost zero memory of how. It's all just one big blur of sitting too close to a compact monitor from Rent-A-Center and different bodily fluids. While I was lying in bed wearing Pikachu pajamas and watching kids' WB cartoons on a Saturday morning, my dad handed me a big envelope from the good people at NYU Admissions. I was accepted into early admission for Tisch. I got in! I got into NYU! I screamed while jumping on the bed, reminding myself to leave the Pokemon PJs out of the retelling of this beautiful moment. That's nice, baby, Dad calmly mumbled while patting me on the top of the head like I was about to get a begging strip. It was much too early in the morning to expect enthusiasm. But lack of congratulations aside, I had accomplished a goal. I was the only student in my high school to make it into NYU that year. I had absolutely no idea how, but I did it, and nothing could bring me down. 2 weeks later, something brought me down. I had been saving all my money in the top left drawer of my writing desk. I loved my writing desk. My mother had brought it home from a patient's house after the person died and would clearly no longer be using it. It had a hutch resting on top that I filled with books, comics, the growing collection of action figures I had purchased for myself, and taped up drawings of my anime creations. It was the most special place in the world. I would sit at my computer or the kitchen table to do homework, but the writing desk was reserved for entering the dozens of worlds I had created. Its drawers were filled with full notebooks, sketchbooks, a possible ghost, and a wad of cash I had earned writing poems and stories atop it. When the time came to send a money order into NYU to reserve my spot for the next year, I opened my secret hiding spot and saw nothing. My money had vanished. As a stream of expletives flew out of my mouth, I racked my mind for all the possible scenarios. Maybe our second pit bull, Kagome, whom I named after the schoolgirl heroine in the anime Inuyasha, had taken it as a chew toy. She seemed like kind of a dick. Maybe I had accidentally placed it into the wrong drawer after gently spooning it the other night. Or maybe when you hear hoofbeats, you think horses, not zebras. I knocked on my parents' bedroom door like the FBI during a raid. Where is my money? Did you take my money? I questioned the particle wood door. It swung open and Ma appeared. Yeah, baby, you told me I could. What? But I said you could have a few bucks if you needed it, like for eggs or rice. I was mid-blubber. Well, I needed it for rent. We all live here, don't we? Would you rather we live in a motel again? There was no point in fighting. There are some people that no matter how heinous their actions, will always find a way to rationalize them. I spent days sulking. Opportunity was so very close to my reach, but it slipped away as quickly as it came. I was back at square boned. At school, I confided in Mr. Donnelly, a teacher who ran the peer mediation group I was a member of. Basically, we were the school solution to fighting and bullying. If two kids got in some sort of tiff, instead of being yelled at by teachers, we would be brought in to help them communicate safely and find a peaceful solution to their conflict. I know, the irony. Mr. Donnelly was sympathetic. He offered to call NYU and ask for an extension of my payment deadline, Maybe I would find a way to scrub enough toilets and mop enough floors to make the $500 I needed. I sat in his office as he called the financial office, my fingers nervously interlocked. Everything seemed to be going well. His kind approach and apparent faith in me sealed the deal, and I heard him thank them for bending the rules just this once. But then the woman on the other end of the line asked if she could speak to me for a moment. "Miss Mendez, we would be happy to give you a few more weeks to hold your spot, but can I be honest with you for a moment? I don't mean to sound insensitive, but this is a very expensive school. If you are having trouble affording $500, maybe you should consider other options." All I wanted to do was hang up the phone and cry. Well, I also wanted to graduate from NYU and then use my diploma as kindling to burn her home to the ground, but mostly I wanted to cry. Looking back, I understand her point. It made sense, but at the time it was just another adult, someone I was supposed to trust to have my best interests at heart, who didn't have any interest in supporting me. A few days later, as I was fiddling through my locker, probably wondering if joining the circus was still a thing, my close friend and fellow peer mediator, Sophie, jumped behind me with a giant smile on her face. "Guess what we did?" she practically sang. As I scrolled through my Rolodex of mean responses that would surely wipe her smile off her face, she pushed a giant manila envelope into my arms. "Mr. Donnelly and the peer mediation group got together and went to every classroom and school collecting money. A lot of it is in change, but we did it. We raised almost the whole $500 you needed." My heart was a messy blender filled with appreciation, embarrassment, swallowed pride, and pure, unadulterated joy. Though it physically pained me to have to rely on anyone, let alone strangers, for help, I couldn't help but feel deeply moved. Kids had done something kinder, braver, and more generous than any grown-up I knew, and there was not one well-off person in that whole school. We were all flat broke, so the fact that they shared what little they had to help one of their own succeed is enough to occasionally restore my faith in humanity. This was it. This time, everything was going to be okay. I was so sure of it. Chapter 6. Lie to Me. New York City holds a special place in my heart. It was the first city I saw live wrestling at the legendary Madison Square Garden. I was just about to turn 17 and already steadfastly believed I would be a pro wrestler one day. But actually witnessing the spectacle in person, experiencing the electricity in the sold-out arena, really sealed the deal for me. For a few hours, I actually got to live within the reality of my dream. That night, it was no longer an out-of-reach, distant fantasy. It was tangible. It was real. Getting a taste of it only made me want more. Every time I would picture myself inside a wrestling ring, I imagined performing in front of the raucous New York City crowd I had once been a part of. And since then, New York City had represented the pinnacle of success. It was the path to escaping my past. It was the destination at the end of a long, arduous journey. When I moved into a dorm room in the heart of New York City's Greenwich Village to start my first year at New York University, I felt like I was finally where I belonged. My mother had complained that I packed my things like someone who had no intention of returning. As we both stared at my barren bedroom, it was clear my entire life was now jammed into boxes labeled fragile. I tried to assure her I was just being prepared, making sure I had everything I needed. But she was right. A part of me was so desperate to be on my own, far away from the memories of childhood, that I was trying to cut ties. I hoped that this was what my parents needed, too. I was the last child living at home, and the requisite responsibilities to the household were overwhelming for an 18-year-old. A college freshman's only concerns should be schoolwork and parties, and part of me wanted to run toward that future without looking back. I thought if I showed them tough love and let them fend for themselves for at least a year, maybe they would grow stronger. I knew I would need to check in to make sure they were eating and paying the bills on time, but I hoped they would be able to take care of things from now on. Moving my belongings into the dorm was a bittersweet experience. I felt the weight of responsibility that came along with entering college. I was officially an adult. And that pissed me off because I never really got to be a kid. I felt like I had been saddled with duties and worry from as early as I could remember, and the door to a carefree childhood was now firmly closed. But despite my concern that walking through my dorm room threshold meant entering the real world, I knew I was prepared for it more than any of my schoolmates. I was certain the majority of attendees at the prestigious school, the children of privilege, had never had to survive on dry noodles or shank a fool on Christmas Eve. Even though the room was musty, had no air conditioning on a 95-degree August afternoon, and consisted of gray cement walls as inviting as a women's penitentiary, I thought it was the most beautiful place on earth. Within these four walls, all that would be asked of me was that I get good grades. Here, I would learn to harness my creativity, turn it into a career, and make a better life for myself. I would try to make this home. And for a while, that was exactly what it became. I was surrounded by everything I needed. I lived right next to beautiful Washington Square Park and would walk to class every day with a Cuban coffee in hand and a skip in my step. New York City in the fall is a thing of beauty. With red and orange leaves crunching beneath my feet, I would pass by whatever Will Smith or Matt Damon movie was filming that day on my walk through the city streets that make up the NYU campus. I would sit among writers, performers, and artists and get actual school credits for activities that had just been beloved hobbies only weeks before. A moment of epiphany came one day in a writing class when my teacher suggested the most important rule of prose was write what you know. Everyone has their own life story, she advised, and drawing from that was the key to original and authentic work. My whole life, after every trial or heartbreak, I had told myself it had happened for some unknown, greater reason. That it was happening to me because I was strong enough to handle it and capable enough to pass on the lessons I learned. In a way, this felt like exactly what she was talking about. Writing and storytelling could be my way to catharsis. Also, my roommate didn't believe in television, so I could play my PS2 uninterrupted all day long. This was exactly where I needed to be. When Robbie and Erica hit the age of 18, they embraced their independence, much as a facehugger and alien embraces an unexpected face. They leaped toward their new lives without looking back. Erica was studying to get a degree in education. Her days were also fully occupied with sorority life and a long-term boyfriend. Robbie had been honorably discharged from the Army's 82nd Airborne Division. Two tours of duty, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq, had left him with severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. On the Army's dime, he enrolled in college in a distant suburb of New Jersey. Neither had the time nor desire to come home for visits or check in with phone calls. They wanted to find their place in the world somewhere far, far away from any reminder of where their journeys began. They each wanted to create newer, happier versions of themselves. And that meant cutting ties with painful memories. I understood how they felt, but I had been the one left behind to witness how their decisions affected my parents. In Janet's and Robert's minds, they had truly tried their best, and their efforts were rewarded with the sound of cartoon tires burning rubber as they sped away. Now that I was free to do the same, I began to feel tremendous guilt in building a life of my own, guilt for desiring that clean slate. And so the pressure I felt to take care of my parents only intensified. There was no one else who could do the job. I tried to make myself believe I could handle the burden of parenting my parents while becoming my own adult. For a while, I was pretty good at the balancing act. Every weekend, I would take the train, followed by the bus, and travel for 2 hours to visit the parentals. I would finish my schoolwork in my old bedroom and help with chores around the apartment, cleaning, cooking, food shopping. Over time, it began to feel like the chores at home were piling up. Every surface seemed dustier than the week before. The same dishes filled the sink. It was as if time hadn't moved while I was away at school for the week. When a class assignment would make it impossible to travel home, I would worry about how much work was piling up for me back in New Jersey. What had changed? Why did my parents seem to be letting things fall by the wayside? I became increasingly confused when, upon entering the apartment one Saturday morning, my normally prickly mother greeted me with an all-consuming hug. The warm embrace took me aback, as tenderness had become a vestigial part of her ever-changing personality. She enveloped me, letting her body slowly go limp on mine for an uncomfortable length of time. As she ran her hands through my hair, her chin resting on my shoulder, I could feel the wetness of her tears begin to trickle down my arm. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"Nothing. Just happy to see you," she meekly responded.
I thought about that welcome home hug on the entire trip back to school Sunday night. Something was very different about my mother. I had gotten a job on a student-made film and wasn't able to return home for a few weeks while working on it. When I finally made it back to Jersey, I was horrified by what I saw when I walked through the door. Again, Ma had thrown her weight against me, almost collapsing in relief to see me. And as she stroked my hair, she whispered, "I used to have pretty long hair, too." I looked at the scalp nuzzling into my neck and saw it was littered with bald spots. "What did you do?" I asked, alarmed. It sounded as if a weakened child spoke, using her mouth.
"Sometimes I get a little nervous, and I start pulling it out. Now it's all gone."
I didn't understand what was happening. All I knew was that it felt as if my mother was slowly melting away. Each week, she seemed smaller and daintier, weaker and more vulnerable. The same woman who had scared the ulcers into my intestines was now a dog without bark or bite. When I questioned my father about her ripping patches of hair out of her scalp, he didn't seem too worried. "She's just sad all her kids left her." The phrasing of this was grating. Left her. Children are supposed to grow into adults. The logical side of me knew that much. They are supposed to leave the nest and build lives of their own. I understood that Robbie and Erica had grown distant, and I felt bad for my parents. But it felt as if my dad was embracing the pity party a little too strongly. Parents should encourage their children to go out into the world and grow as humans, not make them feel guilty about it. Going to college is not a form of abandonment. Somehow, their immature personalities had taken our development and natural life progression as a slap in the face, as an ungrateful insult. And now, along with the hard adjustment of life as a freshman in a challenging school, I was saddled with the responsibility of keeping my mother from completely falling apart. I think maybe she should talk to someone, like a doctor or maybe a psychiatrist, I hesitantly told Dad, knowing it would not go over well. The Mendez family did not believe in psychiatry. They did not believe in mental illness. They would not allow their brains to be so weak. "I don't ever want to hear you talk like that again," he brushed the subject off. "Your mother is not a crazy person." I went home every weekend. My college friends would complain I didn't hang out with them or go to parties, and I tried to find any excuse other than explaining that I was too busy trying to keep my mother alive. We were 18-year-olds on very different wavelengths. I lay awake at night, worried about what I would find when I arrived home each Saturday morning. In my heart, I feared coming home to a dead body. Using the little money I had from part-time jobs, I bought minutes for a prepaid cell phone and made sure it was used for nothing else but calling my mother every single day. Yeah,
minutes were a thing, robot children of the future. Though it was a decade ago, it was still pretty embarrassing to not have a real cell phone. Guys would ask for my number, and I couldn't give it to them, which was probably for the best, since I was in no condition to share my bizarre life with anyone. Yeah, I spend my time reading, writing, and providing a 24-hour suicide hotline for my mother. And what do you do?